was a night before Christmas, and all through the place, not a creature was stirring or showing his face. The stockings were hung on the chimney with care, with everyone hoping they'd be getting their share.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Not all families are home for the holidays. There are soldiers and sailors who are deployed all over the world during the season. And then there are families with loved ones in prison. Family members can't always visit, while inmates can't always get time on the phone line on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. This can be especially true for families of inmates in high-security prisons. And many of these prisons in rural Appalachia, like the Red Onion State Prison in southwestern Virginia, aren't accessible by public transportation. But families of inmates in seven prisons in central Appalachia are able to connect to their loved ones through a radio show called Hip Hop from the Hilltops Calls from Home. WMMT broadcasts the show from the Apple Shop studio in Whitesburg, Kentucky, on Monday nights from 7 to 10. The producer takes music requests for the first couple of hours, and from 9 until 10, families leave recorded messages for their loved ones in prison. About five people, including producer Sylvia Ryerson, rotate time in the studio to field calls. Ryerson says her friend Amelia Kirby, who still hosts the show every month, is also a part of the collective.
My friend Amelia had just come home from college and started her own hip-hop show and was doing a weekly show and started getting just dozens of letters every week from men that were incarcerated that listened to her show. And one night she got a phone call from a woman in the D.C. area who said, my brother is incarcerated at Red Onion State Prison and I know he listens to your show every week. Would it be okay if I just go on air and say hi to him, give him a shout out? And Amelia said, sure, please do, go right ahead. And so that night, that woman gave the first shout out. She just went on live and said hello to her brother. And then it just kind of snowballed from there and grew really organically.
That was 2000. Now, 14 years later, there's a team of DJs that help put Calls from Home on the air each week. Every Monday night, there are dozens of family members trying to get through to leave messages. Around Christmas time, the lines to the radio station are overloaded with families trying to get through. Like this one, recorded last year just before Christmas. It's a call from a mother sending this message to her two sons in prison.
I'm loving and missing you guys even more because of the holidays, but we are going to get through it. Just wish you guys were here with me, but just keep praying that one day we will be together. I'm sending you hugs and kisses from your mom. Love you very much. You have a good night. God bless.
In the spirit of Christmas and goodwill towards all people, we wanted to play you a few of the past messages that family members from all over the country sent right before Christmas.
Merry Christmas. This is your little sister Kay. And all these little kids in here, everybody say, hey, Merry Christmas.
We love you, little Eddie. Love you, little bro.
All right, you good, everybody? We love you. Keep your head up. We're proud of you, and we'll hear from you soon. Happy holidays, Merry Christmas, and a Happy New Year.
To my son, Mr. Devon Hall, Dad, love you, man. Always, forever, my brother, love you, man. Wish you were here, but you're always here with us in spirit, soul, and mind, body, and soul. Saying we never going to give up.
Happy holidays,
Uncle. Happy holidays, Uncle James.
It's Gabriel.
It's Gabriel.
We love you.
We love you.
So, yeah, but we're okay, babe, and I miss you, and I wish you could call and leave me a message. But I loved your letter, and I hope you've got some of mine. I miss you, love, like bunches and bunches. And I'm right there beside you, babe. Night-night. I love you, love you, love you, love you. Have a good night, babe.
Our producer, Roxy Todd, will have more about the Calls from Home program on next week's show. Calls from Home is broadcasted live from the WMMT station in Whitesburg, Kentucky, every Monday night from 9 until 10. We've posted a link on our website where you can find out more, wvpublic.org. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear memories of Christmas traditions, new and old. This is Inside Appalachia.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Consumers will buy about 30 million Christmas trees this holiday season. Many of them will have been grown in North Carolina, the state's second in Christmas tree production behind Oregon. It's a $100 million a year industry in the Tar Heel State. WUNC Radio's environmental reporter Dave DeWitt visited a farm to follow a Christmas tree from the mountains to his own living room.
Our Christmas tree begins here, clinging to its 5 by 5 foot patch of ground on the side of a soil-covered hunk of granite in the Blue Ridge Mountains. The slope dips down several hundred feet below where we're standing. Fraser firs of all shapes and sizes, surrounded by Dutch white clover, covers the landscape.
So there's the holler. Can you see what's called Smoky Holler? So it's a beautiful place up here.
Della Deal lives with her husband Buddy and their three kids back down the other side of the hill. This is their farm, the Smoky Holler Christmas Tree Farm. On a clear, bright day like this one, you can see Virginia from up here. Cars whisk by on the nearby Blue Ridge Parkway, close enough that you can see them, but far enough away that you can't hear them. It's as peaceful and serene a setting as one can imagine, until harvest season. Beautiful late fall days like this one are more than just pretty to look at in Christmas tree country. It means a lot of work can get done. Della Deal explains as we bounce back down the hill in her truck.
I mean, we work 6 days a week from July through October, but this is 7 days a week, and you just work till you get it done.
The Deals are among the 1,500 Christmas tree farmers in North Carolina. Most live in this four-county area of Allegheny, Ashe, Avery, and Watauga counties. These are mostly family farms. Della's parents have been tree farmers since the 1950s.
Growing Christmas trees in western North Carolina really saved the small family farms up here, because most folks were producing beans and cabbage, and those markets went away as all that agriculture moved out west to larger farms. Christmas trees really filled that void and saved a lot of these small farms.
An average Christmas tree takes 13 years to grow. It gets put into the ground when it's 5 years old and then grows a foot a year. Fraser firs do especially well in the North Carolina mountains due to the high elevation, cool summers, plenty of rainfall, and well-drained soils. Each tree gets trimmed, fertilized, shaped, and otherwise cared for approximately 100 times in its lifetime. Earl Deal, a former forest biomaterials professor at NC State and the patriarch of the family, is in his 70s, but still gets up at 4 a.m. every day to hand shape every tree.
Our biggest problem compared to other agricultural crops is how labor intensive it is. There's a lot of hand work in shaping the trees. It worries us.
Much of that labor is needed in the fall, and it comes from immigrant workers. The Deals participate in the H-2 guest worker program, flying dozens of legal temporary workers in from Mexico and housing them on the farm. After the work is done, they go back home to their families. Buddy Deal says no American citizen who has come to them and asked for a manual labor job has lasted more than a day.
It's very hard to find people willing to do this kind of labor. To load one of those 9 to 10 foot trees, it may weigh 130 pounds. And those guys pick them up and load them one after another until we've loaded 50,000 trees. So it's unpleasant.
The Deals hope changes to immigration laws would make it easier to employ legal workers. Environmental concerns are changing their industry as well. A decade or so ago, customers began asking about organic trees. Della took it upon herself to grow some, spending countless hours fine-tuning the process. This year, their first organic trees are hitting the lots. But Della isn't so sure it will be a big market.
I'm not totally sold on organic. I think it's more of a marketing tool than it is an actual environmental practice. We still have to use organic pesticides on those trees to keep the mites and stuff out. And we use a whole bunch of chicken litter to fertilize them.
Other concerns are more immediate. More and more buyers think cutting down a live tree and putting it in their living room is not environmentally sound and have opted for fake trees.
Well, shoot, it'd be better for the environment if we didn't even celebrate Christmas now, wouldn't it? You know, we wouldn't have presents and wrapping paper and everything.
Jill Sidebottom is a Christmas tree extension agent at NC State.
A fake tree is made of plastic, and, you know, once it's thrown away, it just goes into the landfill. It doesn't have any environmental benefits, whether it's, you know, the creation of oxygen or the creation of habitat for wildlife or anything.
After our tree is cut down at the Smoky Holler Tree Farm, it's hauled here to the distribution center. It's a one-lane loading zone, hard by a mountain creek and ringed by large white pines. Specific choices made by the deals to keep the trees cool and damp after they're cut. There's also an elaborate canopy of tarps tied to the white pines, covering the trees until they're ready to be put on a truck. The 18-wheelers run constantly in and out of here from early November to mid-December. The biggest trees go to churches in Florida and mansions in New Jersey. Ours is loaded up with a few hundred others and heads out for a Rite Aid parking lot in South Durham.
Anna, would you rather have a fake tree or a real tree?
A real tree. Because then you can actually, like, climb in and stuff.
So you wouldn't exactly be able to climb it? Because it's a Christmas tree and they don't really have branches that you can climb on. And it's really short.
A lot of discussion goes into getting our family tree, even if we're not all sure yet about the rules. Once we're on the lot, my daughter goes off to look for trees to climb, and my two sons get down to business.
Sorry, I just don't see how this is 7 to 8 feet.
Look at that.
This one is pretty good.
That one's awesome.
7, 8.
That one's great.
And that's that. A tree is selected, a fresh cut is made on the end, and it's loaded onto the top of the minivan. In a few minutes, it's home. When the holidays are over, it will be used to shore up a wall of the kids' fort in the woods behind our house. About that same time, somewhere in the Blue Ridge Mountains, Earl Deal will wake up in the dark at 4 a.m. and head out into the cold, thin air to do the hand trimming, getting ready for next year's batch of trees. Dave DeWitt, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
Rocking around the Christmas tree at the Christmas party hop. Mistletoe hung where you can see every couple tries to stop.
Finding that perfect tree is part of many family traditions. For me, we stopped at the same country store close to my grandmother's house every year. Dad was loyal to the owner until it closed. Last year, I stopped by a tree farm in Mercer County, West Virginia.
Fake Christmas trees, they're really, like, they're not fun because you just pack it up in a box and put it up for next year. The other one, you get to go pick out a different one every year, and it's always unique.
11-year-old Maggie Jones just finished helping her family pick out the perfect natural Christmas tree. This is her family's second year back to the Mountain Vista Christmas Tree Farm in Mercer County.
We finally found the right one.
Now, what makes the right Christmas tree for your family?
That it's really full, so we can hang a lot of ornaments on it, and it's not too tall, so we can put the star on the tree. Turner found one, and then I found one, and the other one was better that I picked out.
Oh, yours was better?
Yeah.
Turner is her brother.
Once you go up this hill over right where it is, there's like a fire pit, and then all the trees are in like rows.
Okay.
So to go through and pick them out, and sometimes you have to watch out for you not to step on any trees because some of them they're just planted.
Turner helped his father Doug make the final strokes on the saw to cut the trunk.
It's why I had kids, you know, is to spend time with them and it's one reason I'm a teacher is because I have more time to spend with my children and that's I guess I have enough age and experience to know that time is not something that you can buy, you know, and it's limited. It's important.
The Jones family tree is sitting in the back of a pickup truck this year.
It's about just getting out with the family, and it's kind of like an adventure. You know, last year we tied it on top of the van, which was kind of scary, so I borrowed my nephew's truck this year, so we didn't have to have the worry of it falling off. But now we're kind of cramped in a truck, and I didn't realize this, but they hadn't never ridden in a pickup truck before in the front like that.
The family shares a few memories as they sip hot chocolate. Even though on this first day of winter, it's almost 60 degrees, still, it's a tradition. Jones says he also tries to make it a habit to support local business. Mountain Vista Christmas Tree Farm is owned and operated by the Lusk family. Traditional Christmas music, along with primitive products like bags of coal and pine cones, greet visitors inside a building adorned with wood siding that matches the neighboring house. Miss Lusk is standing behind a large table as she works with winter greenery to create wreaths, trees, and other primitive crafts. Her son, Thomas Lusk, has just returned from college to help with the family business.
It's been a lot of fun. Dad's dad did it with him when he was a kid, getting ready to go to college, and so he wanted to do the same with us. So it was kind of a generational thing. So we planted the trees probably 12 or 13 years ago and have watched them grow, and it's been fun, been exciting getting ready to open up.
Thomas says his sister even helps to offer horseback rides, and when it snows, the hillside is perfect for a sleigh ride.
Sarge, come here. Come here, Sarge. Come on, Sarge. One time I want to say hi. Can I have a handshake before I go? Hey, Sarge.
But for Maggie, it was the friendly dog named Sarge that pulled her back. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in Princeton. While finding the perfect tree is an older tradition, a company in West Virginia is taking a story from 1985 to help create new memories. Over the last 6 weeks, 15,000 people have ridden the Polar Express train in Randolph County. 35 other Polar Express trains exist across the country, but the one in Elkins is the only Polar Express in the Mid-Atlantic region, so it's extremely popular. The Polar Express also supports dozens of local jobs, at least seasonally. Our producer, Roxy Todd, boarded the themed train recently, riding all the way to West Virginia's North Pole.
Golden ticket! Make sure you get your gold!
2-year-old Mason Rudder is one of about 50 children, dressed in pajamas, who are all waiting to board the Polar Express. This theme train is based on the animated film, which stars the voice of Tom Hanks.
Well, you coming?
Where?
Why, to the North Pole, of course. This is the Polar Express!
The plot and animation of the film is based on the children's book of the same title. The main character is a young boy who's questioning whether he believes in Santa Claus. On Christmas Eve, a steam engine train stops in front of his house, and the conductor invites him aboard to ride all night to the North Pole. Meanwhile, in Elkins, Riley Galloway says this is the first time she's ever been on a train.
I like the song when they do the hot chocolate.
Oh, we got it! Hot, hot, hey! We got it! Hot, hot, whoa, we got it!
Riley's here with her cousin Haley and her grandfather. They drove to Elkins from Pittsburgh to ride the Polar Express.
That's all she's been talking to you about for the last 2 months. So quite an experience for them, I think.
Once aboard, everyone is served hot chocolate. And local actors even do the hot chocolate dance, Riley's favorite part of the Polar Express.
Hot chocolate, here we only got one rule. Never, ever let it cool. Keep it cooking hot. Soon you got hot chocolate.
These are paid actors from the old brick playhouse. But volunteers also help by inviting Santa himself into their community to greet the train.
The North Pole actually is a volunteer project that's done by the Billington On Track.
Bonnie Branciroli is the marketing director for the Durban and Greenbrier Valley Railroad.
So when you actually get to the North Pole later this evening, you'll see the Billington On Track folks out there all dressed in their elf outfits and their Mrs. Claus, and that's where Santa boards. I know he boards there, but I don't know where he comes from.
Once we're at the North Pole, the train slows, but something isn't right. The train doesn't stop. Just like the movie, the kids leap from their seats and begin shouting. And when the train slows enough for Santa to board the train, the kids go crazy.
Merry Christmas!
Magic bells are distributed to each of the riders. Magic, because only those who believe in Santa can hear them ring. John Smith, the owner of this railroad, says his company plans to be doing more themed entertainment train rides like this one in the future.
Next year, we'll be operating the railroad portion of the cast train. There'll be packages to go to the theaters, entertainment and cast, stay in the hotels here, that kind of thing.
At least for now, the hour-long Polar Express train is by far the most popular, mostly because the movie is such a hit with kids. Aboard the train, the children are silently sipping their hot chocolate as the Polar Express book is read over the speakers.
The train was filled with other children, all in their pajamas and nightgowns.
We drank hot cocoa as thick and rich as melted chocolate bars.
Outside, the lights of towns and villages flickered in the distance as the Polar Express raced northward. Soon, there were no more lights to be seen. We traveled through cold, dark forests where lean wolves roamed, and white-tailed rabbits hid from our train as it thundered through the quiet wilderness. We climbed mountains so high, it seemed as if we could scrape the moon.
And on the West Virginia Polar Express, we too ride the train through darkness, and the trees of the forest loom large against the window pane. Children snuggle against their parents, and the slow motion of the train rocks many of them into a brief but peaceful sleep. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Roxy Todd in Elkins.
It's time for What's in a Name. In honor of the holidays, we found a special town that might make you want to find someone to kiss. So pucker up, Buttercup. What is it? We'll have the answer after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. Your Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. If you wanted to surprise your love with a kiss, where would you go? Well, Mistletoe, Kentucky, of course. Although the post office in Mistletoe has been shut down for a few years now, we found the former postmaster assistant, Judy Couch, to tell us the story behind Mistletoe.
I've been told that when they came here to establish the post office, they couldn't decide what to name it. And they saw mistletoe growing up in the trees, and someone asked what it was, and another person said, that's mistletoe, and that's how the name came about.
Have you seen mistletoe growing much there?
Yes, I've seen it, but there's not very much here anymore. We had really, really bad winters back in the 80s, and it seemed, I guess it froze out. We don't have very much here anymore.
And with the name like Mistletoe around Christmas time, I imagine there's probably a lot of people that would want to mail out letters from the post office.
Oh, yeah. They sent them in packages through the mail to be delivered here to get cancellations, right? From all over the United States. And we had a few from Russia and different places like that.
So they would send it to you so that you would mail it back out with mistletoe stamped?
It would have postage already on it, the stamps already on it. We would cancel it with a hand cancel and send it back to them.
That's nice of you. Was it ever annoying to have to deal with that at Christmas time?
It was rough.
Yeah.
Hard work and no extra pay. My husband was postmaster all those years and I was assistant, and he's no longer here. He's passed away in 2005.
Well, thank you so much. And happy holidays and Merry Christmas.
Same to you.
Thank you.
Bye.
So that's what's in the name of Mistletoe, Kentucky. If you have another story or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at In Appalachia and we might explore it. Inside Appalachia.
Merry Christmas to all and to all a good night. Merry Christmas to all and to all a good night.
Beckley actress, playwright, and historian Karen Varanche brings us a lovely passage from a piece written by Richard Madison called Christmas in the Appalachian Mountains.
It's Christmas in the Appalachian Mountains. The snow glistens from the rays of the morning sun and dances across the roof of a small log cabin perched on a rocky slope. Smoke swirls out of the chimney from the pot-bellied stove. Imagine that today is the 6th of January, or the 12th day after Christmas, the Epiphany. The day folk legends say is the day the baby Jesus was born. In the old days, most mountain people recognized January 6th as Old Christmas and celebrate that day. Folk legends say that on this day, the elderberry bush will sprout under the frozen snow. In a distance, a gunshot sounds, fired from an old musket. Another shot answers several miles away through the crisp mountain air. The Christmas celebration has begun. Inside the cabin where the family have gathered, a Christmas carol is sung. Grandpa plays the banjo while Aunt Mary plays the fiddle. They are singing the 12 days of Christmas that Grandfather learned when he was little from his grandfather. And traditions of the mountain folk grow, from father to son and mother to daughter. In these meager surroundings, there's laughter and prayer. The faith is strong, but the cupboard is bare. The gifts are homemade toys whittled from oak and decorated with corn silk and hickory stain. Today we celebrate in a place that time has forgotten. It's Christmas in the Appalachian Mountains.
Karen Varanche is a storyteller from Fayetteville, West Virginia. When we come back, we're going to hear about how one small town in West Virginia wouldn't let a fire snuff out their Christmas spirit.
Oh, beautiful star.
Traditions are a big part of Appalachian culture. So much, in fact, that for one town, not even a fire could keep them from a Christmas celebration. A fire devastated one block of Main Street, Marlinton, West Virginia, in November of last year. Kelly Tabor with Allegheny Mountain Radio reports that the town is rebuilding, recovering, and trying to remain optimistic that business investment will transform the empty blocks into more than vacant lots.
Christy Lanier, owner of the Dirt Bean Coffee Shop, woke in the early morning hours of November 10th to an apartment filled with smoke. She lived in the apartment above her cafe and bike shop in downtown Marlinton, next to the Greenbrier River Trail that runs from Pocahontas County to Greenbrier County. The fire was actually in a neighboring building, and by the time she was out on the street, smoke had consumed the building. She ran back into her apartment to rescue her dog and watched on the street as the fire burned. The buildings on the corner in the center of town smoldered and smoked for weeks, and remained a burned-out wreck for months before being cleared off, which is how they remain now, three vacant lots in the center of town.
Little things will remind me of this time last year. I think I was actually involved. They were tearing down my building, like, New Year's Eve. I was over there sifting through rubble. So, yeah, it's like, I have my moments where I'm like, but I think the... there's definitely a lot of good that's come out of it, too.
She reopened Dirt Bean on September 25th of this year, the 10-year anniversary of the business, after substantial renovations to the building on 3rd Avenue, beside the Pocahontas Opera House around the corner from her former location.
There's a lot that's been very positive that's come out of it, and people have helped and been great, and I tried not to think about it too much, and there's people, you know, on that anniversary of the fire kind of wanting to talk or say things to me, and coincidentally, I didn't schedule myself off that day on purpose, but it happened to fall on a Monday, and I usually take Mondays off, and so I just kind of hit out and did my own thing, and accidentally referred to it as my birthday when I was talking to myself that day. I was like, well, you know, I don't have to go to work. It is my birthday. I can do whatever I want. And I realized, I'm like, wait, it's not my birthday. It's the anniversary of the fires. Yeah, I've had an interesting time this month, kind of, yeah, flashback to that night, you know, getting out and realizing how close I was to not getting out.
Her shop is now decorated with a Christmas tree, and business is swift, especially during special events in town like the Marlinton Christmas Parade, held the first Friday in December. At the Christmas Parade, lifelong Marlinton resident Jan Miller said she remains hopeful for the town. She watched the parade from the sidewalk, waving to friends and family walking past, as she does each year.
Because I've always lived here, so I can remember the massive fire on that corner, and then this, and it's total devastation to the community.
She would like to see new businesses open downtown.
Some type of a business. I mean, I realize it would have to be like a mom and pop type business, or something like Lewisburg, where they have like little antique shops, just anything that would draw people.
Marlinton Mayor Joe Smith said he is waiting on a deal to come through that would bring some holiday cheer to the hearts of townsfolk, and maybe to their bellies as well. Rumor has it that Tudor's Biscuit World might open a restaurant downtown. Tudor's corporate offices in Charleston, West Virginia, said they were not able to confirm at this time.
This, within the last couple of months, this became a really good prospect for a business to build on a vacant lot. It's not definite yet, and I'm not at liberty to disclose who it may be. The owner of the property wants to make that announcement if it happens, but it's real promising. The new building on the corner. There's three different ownerships there involved in that whole block. And the man that owned the corner, the old bank building, as we called it, he has a real good prospect. And the people from the corporate office has been in and looked at the area and was pleased. And it's real promising.
Despite the vacant lots on Main Street, Smith said the town still has lots to offer for Christmas shoppers.
Just wish everybody a Merry Christmas and hope they'll come to town and shop and visit us and see our nice decorations we have this year. The town crew worked very hard to get them done this year between the rains, and if we can get something built on that vacant lot or on a portion of that vacant lot, it would really be nice. It really be. I sure myself think there might be a balloon effect if we can see one thing done. I think maybe something else might move on down. So now, today, I would like to be able to say that by this time next year, we're going to see that lot filled back up with businesses. But I can't say that, but it'd be awful good to say that.
For Allegheny Mountain Radio News, this is Kelly Tabor.
This story is about the 2014 parade, but we should point out that last year, Marlinton still went ahead and had the parade just days after the blaze. The holidays bring their own special food traditions, too, and one that Fred Salzman from WETS is especially fond of is homemade eggnog with roots in eastern Kentucky, East Tennessee, and Ecuador. Check it out.
It was Christmas 1983, and Joe Florence had just been assigned as a National Health Service Corps doctor to Erie, Kentucky, working at a clinic in a community called Home Place. Dark came early in the one-stop sign town surrounded by mountains. Joe and his wife Kay were hosting a Christmas party, and when they looked out into that darkness, they spotted a lady bearing a punch bowl. It was Joe's colleague Calla Bassett, and she'd brought eggnog.
My experience with eggnog previously had been
not a particularly one that was very memorable.
That changed once Joe tasted Calla's recipe, brought to Eastern Kentucky from upstate New York. Now eggnog in the Florence family is all about memory. Joe claims he's not much of a cook, but his rendition of his friend's recipe has been repeated every year since he first tasted it. Joe eventually gave up his practice as a country doctor in Appalachian Kentucky, eventually settling in Jonesboro, Tennessee's oldest town, in a house built by a North Carolina privateer around 1820. Joe now directs rural medicine programs for East Tennessee State University. Students call him for advice on such topics as diabetes education in the mountains, but they're just as likely to phone him for the eggnog recipe after he and Kay have served it at an end-of-the-semester party, always in their silver punch bowl.
For our 25th wedding anniversary, Joe got real excited about silver, and so the silver punch bowl was my anniversary present. And we've enjoyed it so much, when our oldest daughter got married, Joe thought that perhaps they should have a silver punch bowl as well. So for their first Christmas, that was his present to them. And I think since both the girls live in Kentucky, between sorority functions and family parties and church activities, I think their punch bowl's been used about as often as ours.
Since younger daughter Carter had talked about it among her friends at Center College in Danville, Kentucky, she decided to bring some eggnog back after Thanksgiving one year.
And they wouldn't drink it because of the raw eggs. And I was so insulted. I, brought this eggnog 4.5 hours back to Danville, and my friends just wouldn't touch it. I even brought freshly ground nutmeg, and I remember being very put out by that because it was such something that we always enjoyed so much.
Considering his medical knowledge, I asked Dr. Joe Florence about the raw eggs.
Most of the time, raw eggs are safe. Particularly raw eggs you buy in a grocery store, because they go through lots of safety checks.
Each year, with a group of medical students, Joe travels to Johnson City, Tennessee's sister city, Guaranda, Ecuador, where he purchases a bottle of vanilla extract as thick as honey. So thick, in fact, that he has to scrape it out of the measuring cup when he adds it to the eggnog.
And it's unlike any vanilla that I have been able to find around here. It's a real extract of vanilla, and it's very thick.
Almost like honey, consistency of honey. Yeah.
The Florences like this eggnog recipe because guests can drink it or eat it. The final addition to the bowl is a half gallon of vanilla ice cream.
And one of the things about this eggnog is this is the way you serve it. In my family, the adult eggnog was said to have nog in it. And so you had regular eggnog that you just served for everybody. And the children ate it. Everybody gets a cup of it and can drink as much as they want to. And certain of the adults like a little extra, though. So they put nog in it.
A shot glass with a Christmas tree on it sits inconspicuously beside the punch bowl, and Carter says you just make sure people don't watch as you pour in some rum or whiskey. Kay says often that's Ecuadorian rum brought back from Joe's travels.
And he's particularly fond of Kentucky bourbon, so we often have a decanter of bourbon out as well, and folks can just doctor it up however they're inclined.
Guests in the Florence home, like the choir members from Jonesboro Presbyterian Church, sprinkle nutmeg over their cups of eggnog from seashell-shaped salt cellars that were given to Kay by a college friend from Appalachian State University. The nutmeg grater is an inheritance from her late mother, Edith Carter Wood.
It has the little place in the top to store the nutmegs, and it's just very nostalgic for me to use that and remember the years that she helped to make the eggnog, and certainly enjoy drinking it.
You'd think I'd have this recipe memorized by now, but since I only make it at Christmas, I don't. So I have to look at it each time. First thing is get fresh eggs and separate them. Never have been much of a cook, so I have to be real careful separating them because I always break one. And if you break one, that just messes up everything.
There are a few things that I've always said that when I get married, my husband has to learn how to do. And one's make pancakes, which is another family tradition, and the other's eggnog.
Around the Florence table each Christmas, eggs, sugar, milk, cream, vanilla, and ice cream stir memories that range from eastern Kentucky to Ecuador. For Inside Appalachia in Jonesboro, Tennessee, I'm Fred Sossman.
Here's a Christmas story based on a traditional Scottish ballad. Once again, storyteller Karen Varanch.
Long ago, in the mountains of southern West Virginia, lived a man by the name of Lockie McLaughlin. Direct from Scotland he was. He and his wife Laura had come to the mountains to make a home for themselves and their family. They built a small log house. Wasn't very much at first. Just a small house enough to hold their growing family. There wasn't a loft for the children to sleep in. There wasn't a proper kitchen area. But it was enough. Laura had another child, and then another. And even when the 10th child came, Lockie McLaughlin held up the baby and said, "Oh, in this house, there's always room for one more. There's always room for one more." They decided to have a Christmas celebration and invite all of their family and friends. Lockie's brother and his family lived on the next ridge over, and they came with all their children. Laura's aunt and cousin, once removed, lived in another part of the mountains, and they visited too with their families. The families came in bearing all sorts of food, all-day green beans and fried chicken and ham. There was chocolate cake, and people ate and ate and ate. They laughed, and when more people would come and visit, they'd say, "Come on in, there's always room for one more. There's always room for one more." Travelers passing on the road would see the lights in the house and hear the merriment and glee and would knock on the door, and Lockie would say, "Come in, there's always room for one more. In this house, there's always room for one more." Four lumberjack coming down the road, having worked in the mountains all winter, saw the lights, and they came in too. "Come in," said Lockie. "There's always room for one more." An itinerant circuit rider preacher was walking down the road, not having made it back to the flatlands before snow fell. "Preacher Brown, come in the house. There's always room for one more." A carpenter, the miller, and a barrel maker too. Each one was invited in with as much hospitality as Lockie could muster. The people ate all the food there was to eat, and their bellies were groaning. But then the fiddle player started, and the banjo player started, and the dancing and the reels and the clogging began. The laughter rang out, and no one noticed this little house bulging at the walls, the rafters groaning, until suddenly there was a loud crack. Someone yelled, "The house is giving way!" People dove out of the windows. They jumped out the door. Preacher Brown skidded to a halt underneath the kitchen table for protection from the rafters falling about them. And when they stopped, they realized the house had fallen completely around them. No one said anything for a while. And then one of the lumberjacks called out, "Come on, boys, let's cut some trees. This man needs a new house." The carpenter got his saw and his hammer. Others got their tools. And the hammering and the shouting and the laughter started. Laura McLaughlin made a big fire, where she made a pot of coffee and cooked all night. She made a bed for the children under tents in the snow. They worked all night into the day, into the next night. And when they were done, there was a fine log house standing there. Lockie McLaughlin walked in the door and looked around. It was twice as big as his last house, a lovely little loft for the children to sleep in, and a nice kitchen area for Laura to cook the food. "This," he said, "is a house where there will always be room for one more." From then on, anyone who visited the mountains of southern West Virginia knew to stop at Lockie McLaughlin's house. He would open the door wide and say, "Come in, come in. There's always room for one more. In my house, there's always room for one more."
In Christmas 1955, at least six people reported seeing a beige mountain lion near Marlinton, West Virginia, according to an article by Calvin Price, who was then the editor for the Pocahontas Times. Browsing through newspaper articles that Price wrote, our producer Roxy Todd worked up the story as part of the Traveling 219 project. This story is about a series of mountain lion sightings that year.
Two children are kneeling beside the Christmas tree, holding their breath as they explore their newly wrapped presents. The smallest one, a boy, crawls beneath the tree. A bell falls from one of the branches, alerting their mother, who looks up from the crackling fire. She asks the children if it's still snowing. She remembers the first Christmas in this home, newly married, before electricity, just the glow of a fire, small, like this one. Smoke rises into the night, unusually bright beneath the waxing moon, the endless blankets of snow. The children are looking out the window now, watching a shape emerge on the snow-covered lawn. A panther is creeping at the edge of their farm. He stretches his neck towards their house to peer into their frozen window. Looking out the window at the terrifying creature, the children feel frozen too. The panther is a dusty beige color, with white flecks of long whiskers on his face. Two dark yellow eyes open wide, staring back at the faces of the children, suspended, unwavering. The little boy cries out. Their mother stands and sees the panther, catches her breath in fright. In defiance, fear, and awe, she locks eyes with the great cat and stares. She calls for her husband, and her voice against the glass startles the panther, who tears through soft, fresh snow and disappears in a flash. That Christmas, at least three other people caught sight of a panther outside their home near Marlinton, and they all called Calvin Price, editor of the Pocahontas Times, and one of the last faithful believers in the great Pocahontas panther. For decades, Price had recorded dozens of these local panther sightings. Price claimed to have seen a live panther himself once, when he was in the woods alone. He says he whistled at it, and it growled and took off through the trees. Officially, the last verified mountain lion killed in West Virginia was back in 1887. But this didn't change the fact that hundreds of people continued, and still continue, to report sightings of mountain lions throughout the Allegheny Mountains. But Christmas of 1955 was one of the last reports Price made about these panther sightings. And it was almost his last Christmas. He passed away in June 1957. Why did that Pocahontas panther come so close to town so many times during that Christmas of 1955? Was it the smell of all those Christmas ham bones tossed outside? Or was it the smoke from the chimneys carrying smells of venison, partridge, and mincemeat pie? Whatever it was, it interested the panther so much that he came back to that little house with the mother and her children a few days after Christmas. This time, she was reading a story to the children, who sat near her lap. The presents, they'd all been unwrapped, but the Christmas tree was still up. The stockings hung at the mantel. A nativity scene still decorated the table. The youngest boy was looking out the window when the panther came back. Their mother turned to see the panther's face in the window, as before. She dropped her book on the floor and called her husband to come look. She and the children rushed to the window, but the panther had already leapt away. The moon, now full, lit up their fields, shining down on the panther as he jumped the high fence into a neighboring farm and disappeared. Close your eyes. And it's not too difficult to see his tail twitching beneath the light of the moon, tracing his own memory in circles across the snow, sniffing out the source of all those who still told stories of him around the fire. He let himself be seen, a kind of last farewell to one who would always believe.
That was Roxy Todd reporting. Just this past week, the Kentucky Department of Fish and Wildlife found a 125-pound young and healthy mountain lion in Bourbon County. Officials are still trying to determine if the large cat was someone's pet or wild. If it's a wild animal, it will be the first one confirmed in Kentucky since the Civil War. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, Fred Salzman from WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, and Karen Varanch. Music in today's show was provided by the Sweetback Sisters and the Bob Thompson Unit as heard on the annual radio jazz show, Joy to the World. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at WV Jessica Y. Lilly. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at WVPublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.